Okay, we're on to this curmudgeon you talked about, who was very interesting. He started the Coogan's Law. Jackie Coogan. You guys went to lunch with him, Uncle Fester.
Yeah,
we paid for lunch with him. I mean,
yeah. I know. I was like, he was telling you just how he was doing well and never had to work again. Then he got up and left you guys with a check.
Yeah. Well,
we always say that if you take that adorable picture of him from that iconic film, The Kid, 1920, with Chaplin, and then put it next to him as Uncle Fester, or the photo we took of him,
that's,
you're going to go,
yeah, you
that
guys,
can't be this.
Creepy and kooky underneath the picture. That's
I mean, you know, he was so adorable. And then, shockingly, in the like late 30s, it's another thing that people can't believe, that Uncle Fester at one point was married to Betty Grable.
I know. I love that. That's an amazing story. But he wasn't that bad. It wasn't like he was handsome, but he wasn't, you know, a movie star.
He was a character guy, character actor, but he certainly was an adorable kid actor.
Oh my gosh, he was very cute.
Yeah.
He was adorable.
Yeah, I guess we all grow up. We all grow up.
We all do. And yes, we're all, you know, whatever. We get older, but we're still cute in some certain way. I hope.
To someone.
Really? You know,
but
rose-colored glasses.
Tell about the, what was it, the mushroom cheese omelet, his stories of Burma and...
We wanted to talk about, you know, the Addams Family and, you know, see if he could light up a light bulb in his mouth or whatever. We were just goofing off. And then he got real serious. He was sort of, well, you know, my Uncle Fester coat is at the Smithsonian, which we never checked on. We don't know if it is. But, you know, and then he said, well, you know, I want to talk about my war experiences in Burma. And, it, you know, he sounded like a one-man Audie Murphy from all these recollections. Like,
heroic.
You know, he had freed India a single handily or something. So, you know, and he was eating his, you know, this mushroom spinach feta cheese omelet, and he had some front teeth issues. So, I mean, he was
missing
brain on glasses. About every 5 minutes, we were kind of like using our napkins to wipe our glasses off because we couldn't really see him, you know, I mean, through all the egg yolk. And then at the end, he's, you know, telling us, well, you know, I don't ever have to work again. And,
financially,
you know,
secure.
Yeah, I'm have $1 million or whatever. And he says, well, you guys are going to get the tab, right? And so he gets up and leaves. And he said, I'll get the tip. And I think he threw down like $1 or something. And then he's...
No wonder,
you know,
why he's
there.
Never going to have financial trouble again.
Well, it was funny. The funniest thing that happened during the interview, we kind of got a kick out of it. Like, okay, here are these impoverished, you know, college kids, but we'll pick up his tab and, you know, and probably add on to the tip because it was $1 and we had been there about $3.
I mean, we were 19, maybe 20, and certainly, you know, we didn't have, you know, the financial means. Again, I mean, with inflation, I'm sure breakfast was a couple bucks back then, but that was up a lot. But, you know, we were staying in hotels that were $27 a night. And, you know, we were, you know, so there was very few stars that stuck us with the bill. Back in the 90s when we were post-college, Virginia Mail stuck us with a fairly extensive bill after lunch in the San Fernando Valley because she had to have the baked Alaska and everything else.
I know, can't do that. Top of the world, Mom.
She was dressed to the nines for that, though. We thought it was sort of cute and sort of sad in a certain way, like she had sort of been forgotten. A lot of stars that we had talked to during that week, we mentioned that we were seeing Virginia Mayo, and they were really interested.
She's still alive.
Gene Kelly was interested. He said, how does she look? And this and that. And she, I mean, she dressed like she was going to the Oscars when we picked her up.
RJ was interested, you know, how that went. And even RJ just a couple of years ago, I don't even know if he knew she had died, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
What I remember her on was doing an interview with Robert Osborne, which was really good. She Virginia really was pretty open mouthed about a lot of things, which I thought.
And she made some decent films.
She made some great films. Best Years of Our Life. Who could have been better
Princess
in that than Virginia?
Pirate with Bob Hope. Yeah,
The Princess and the Pirate, one of Hope's funnier films, and at White Heat with Cagney.
Oh, my God. She was wonderful in that.
Yeah. So she
I liked – I'm very big fan of hers.
Yeah.
How did you guys like Shirley Jones? I always – is she still – she's still with us, right?
Yeah.
That's sure.
Shirley was great. I mean, her husband would sort of butt in and be obnoxious.
That horrible Marty Ingalls?
Yeah, he was a strange guy.
Yeah,
but she was so, you know, it was almost the Shirley Jones marriage to Marty Ingalls, you know, it was sort of the Beauty and the Beast thing. This refined classic. It was a little bit, it was sort of a little bit like Anne Bancroft and Mel Brooks, but somehow it all worked, right? But Shirley, it was at her Beverly Hills home. I think she had moved since then. And you know, we talk, there was a story about how she would talk about how Rod Steiger was sort of, she was her first film, 54, 55 was Oklahoma. That was her film debut. She was a young kid and it was being directed by the great British director, Fred Zinnemann. And, you know, Rod Steiger, Mr. Method actor, Mr. Serious, you know, was pretty much coming on to her, right? I mean, is that right?
He was Judd Fry in the movie, and he had the total hots for her. And then, but Zinnemann, basically, when we interviewed Rod in that same week, we interviewed Rod later, and he said that Zinnemann cock-blocked him by saying... By basically telling him, Rod, you gotta protect Shirley because all these vultures are around her. They all want to get a piece of her because she's hot, and you got to be her protector. So he said, you know, he said Zinnemann was brilliant because in one fell swoop, I became her protector and I was taken out of the game of trying to get dates with her or come on to her. So, yeah.
I don't know if Rod was married at that time. And Tom or Grace, you'll know he was married to the she's still alive. She was the British ballerina that was in the Chaplin film.
She was married
quite a while to Rod Steiger. Another interesting couple.
Very. She was in The Haunting. I loved her in that. So we went through that, and Marty was there the whole time.
Yeah, he would come in and out, and he would have, like, corny gags.
I could never imagine. And her sons hated him, especially Sean. And it was not a harmonious balance, but Marty and Shirley and her sons.
Well, and, you know, I mentioned Shirley wrote one of the two forewords to the first book in 04. And, like, when we first got the draft, it was not Shirley. It was, like, Marty Ingalls with stupid, like, you know, Catskill borscht belt gags.
And ghosted it for Shirley. Yeah.
We sort of had to go back and sort of, you know, work with her to sort of get it back in her voice.
Oh, no. Yeah, oh, well, so he's all sticky.
It was very strange.
Here's Mr. Schtick.
How'd she see him with him?
He was the one that, during one of his things, he was in a bathrobe the entire time when we were interviewing Shirley. And he came in with about a 5 foot by 5 foot blow up of Rod Steiger kind of goosing Shirley on the set of Oklahoma. He's behind her and he has her by the waist. And that was what led to this whole thing with us about Steiger, you know, basically coming clean about being a protector, because Ingalls said, you see this picture, you got to ask Rod about this picture when you see him. You got to ask him about Shirley and what he had to do. And so he wouldn't tell us anything else. So when we got to Steiger's house, we brought that up and he was like, oh my God, you know, yeah. And that's when he told us that Zinnemann had cowed him into being Shirley's protector. So yeah.
She wasn't married to Jack Cassidy yet.
When she was doing Oklahoma?
Yeah.
No, came in the 60s, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
She wasn't married, I don't believe. This was her film debut, so she
was 18.
Yeah.
They met on Broadway. I don't remember when they got married, but they got married pretty young. She wrote an interesting book, that's for sure. And poor Jack, I liked him. And did you know he was the first choice to be Ted Baxter?
Yes. And he played Ted Baxter's brother.
What a ride it was. He's like a sock model. And they're just one-upping each other and wrote us his date.
Yeah, totally competitive.
It was very funny. I love that episode. Okay, this is a guy I have a few problems with, Tony Curtis.
Strange. I always think, you know, when you talk about ego and pretentiousness, when he's telling us about him and Janet and their marriage and how it was all the tabloids went wild and stuff, and he made some comment about, like, Liz and Dick could have been our gardeners or something. I mean, you know, yeah, they were a big deal, but to be pretentious enough to think that Janet and Tony were a bigger deal than Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, I think is probably not too accurate.
Yeah, Tony in his book, he also, you know, he erased some parts of history, made things better, worse. You know, Marilyn's Hitler, I never said that. Well, yeah,
yeah, he told us he never said it.
Yeah, but, I never said kissing Marilyn was like kissing Hitler.
But I think Tony's account of Marilyn's issues during Some Like It Hot that he told us about how she would, you know, she wasn't here, she didn't have her lines down, how she would play him against Jack Lemmon or him against Wilder or Wilder against Lemmon, that she was sort of creating a sort of a chaotic environment on the set. So, and he gave his rationale, which is sort of an adult language in the book. But I think there, you know, there certainly could be some merit to that aspect of the story. I mean, again, they're giving oral histories here, but that's his take on it.
Right. Yeah. And, well, I read Billy Wilder as well, and he said, yeah, you know, she was driving me so crazy, I couldn't wait to get home to see my wife. You know, it's like
difficult.
His wife
is
wonderful. She was difficult, and she had always had the acting coach with her. And but she did a great performance, and nobody can deny that. But
And to Tony's credit, and he says that in the book, you know, yeah, he lost a lot of his career to drugs and cocaine in the 60s. But I mean, he leaves a surprisingly decent portfolio of films.
Yeah.
You know, the Defiant Ones and
the Boston Strangler.
I love the Boston Strangler.
And the one he plays the publicist with Burt Lancaster.
Oh, Sweet Smell of Success.
Yeah, great stuff. And, yeah, you know, you can't – and the Wilder film, which just escaped my name. I'm getting old.
Something like it hot.
Thank you. Yeah. So, I mean, you look at those. I mean, there's just named probably a half a dozen really good films that live on.
Yes. He had an ego, and he was a – he could be a prognost. You know, he could
– he was eccentric.
He was very eccentric. What did you think of his wife, Janet, who is now his ex-wife, Janet?
Janet was a classy lady. When we saw her, she became a novelist, and she was spending most of her time either playing tennis or writing novels. And I don't think much of the Tony conversation came in on the interview with Janet, but I mean, she certainly talked about Hitchcock. I mean, if you look at the book, we have Eva Marie Saint, who just a couple years ago told us the story about Cary Grant, which she said she didn't think she had ever told anyone about, from North by Northwest. We have Tippi Hedren. We have Janet Leigh. So we did get some of Hitchcock's favorite blondes in the book, and we always asked about Hitchcock. And Janet told about her style, Hitchcock's style of storyboarding, but letting the actor sort of do their thing as long as they adhere to where he wanted them to be placed. And that he wanted her to turn up the heat with John Gavin in that bedroom scene. He thought it was lacking a little heat. And so that was the focus that I recall of the conversation. We always tried to get some Hitchcock content.
Yeah, and you did.
Yeah.
And Eva Marie is a darling, because I like her. I've seen her in, in interviews, and her being interviewed by Ben Mankiewicz and stuff for TCM. And I just think, what a darling she is. And I just down to earth and sweet.
Class act all the way.
What do you think of Ann Miller? I've been reading more about her, and she said she thought she was this queen, like in Egypt in her days, and she was quite a character.
She's a total character, and she was of all the MGM ladies we interviewed, and we've interviewed many of them, like Catherine Grayson and others that were part of that, you know, 40s MGM
Debbie.
Meeting. Yeah. She totally conformed almost to the character she portrayed on screen. I mean, she was the most, you know, like them. I mean, she was just completely showbiz pizzazz. She came down this, you know, circular staircase, better, you know, I mean, she was like Nadine in Easter Parade with the Russian Wolfhound. She was a bit of a gossip too.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she was talking a lot about one of her good friends was Robin Astaire, the woman that former jockey married Fred Astaire during his last years, and I remember asking her too, saying, well, you know, Fred did that Dirt Devil, or he's in that Dirt Devil vacuum commercial where he's dancing with a Dirt Devil
instead
of that wooden boat rack from Royal Wedding. I said, you know, I met Fred Astaire once. I don't know if he would have liked that too much. I don't think he would have. And she said, well, you know, the reason why that was done was that Robin needed money to finance her air freight business. She was a pilot. So that was the only reason she sort of, you know, farmed out that number to whoever made that commercial for the Dirt Devil, because it was a payday and she could keep her air freight business afloat, which I thought was just sort of horrible.
And I know. I think it's very horrible.
Really say anything. Yeah, she didn't say anything. She didn't pass judgment like I was, but, you know. But
the MGM ladies, I mean, always, you know, they were trained in that studio system, and while we saw them long after the studio system had disappeared, I mean, they always were gussied up, so to speak. That's an old term. But, you know, whether it's Catherine Gleason.
I love gussied,
gussied up with, you know, wearing the red. And, I mean, they were all classy, and I think Cicerese, Ann Miller, Janet Leigh, I think that all came from, you know, how they were trained to present themselves at the studio.
They used to, I mean, on more than one occasion, these, and actors too, Tony Curtis told us this, being, you know, interviewed by the press was part of their job. That's what they were trained. They weren't trained to see the press as an adversary or something to, you know, give short shrift to. The press was part of their job, just like learning how to fence or ride a horse or doing lines. And that's how they were trained in the studio system. So, you know, 40, 50 years later, they were still very, very nice about meeting us or I'm sure any other, you know, press person that wanted to interview them. Unlike some of the, you know, younger stars we've interviewed where they just, you know, they don't want to be around. They don't want to do it. They might be, you know, kind of in a pissy mood and they'll show that. I mean, these old stars were ready to go. They were primed and ready, and they were almost all of them were polite and were engaged, and it was good. That was a lot of the fun of it was
to do today's stars. I think not all, but many do the publicity that they have to do contractually,
right.
And you can tell they don't like doing it. It's a necessary evil to get a big first weekend box office or whatever is necessary at the junkets and what have you.
And pretending romances and things like that.
Yeah, but, you know, I also think that had those Golden Age stars been here during the social media revolution and the gotcha media and all of the things that are happening, they might be more reticent and guarded to do what they did pre, because it is a different time.
Yes. And if you say something, one thing that, you know, is not seen as woke or politically correct, or if you say one thing, you know, people just jump on you. You know, they're like,
well, exactly.
It's, you know, like, so the Kirk computer Douglas warriors.
At, I mean, if Kirk Douglas at age 95, you know, makes a comment that, you know, hints at being sexist, you know, everyone would jump on him, you know, whatever. You know, it's just it's a different world.
Yeah.
It is a totally different world. I want you guys to tell me, I think we're doing an hour, and I think that's perfect. And I don't want to talk about all your people, because I want everybody to buy your fabulous book. And it's, you know, who we've talked about, we only touch on it. You know, it's not like we go into all the interviews, and there's so many, like I said, 75. And it is a wonderful book, and I have read chapter by chapter by chapter. I go through, like, who I like the best, and then I go back to the other ones. Gregory Peck growled. You talked about him on the last one.
You probably saved George Jessel for last.
How'd you guess?
or Benny Rubin.
I don't know. I'd love to talk. Mervyn LeRoy cracked me up. He didn't give you guys a long one, but you guys cracked me up because you were talking about he was wearing the shirt. His head was too big for his body. He had neck waddle, and it looked like his shirt was just Garrett or something.
I actually have a blown up. I have a large frame photo of Mervyn LeRoy in my house that we took for the simple reason. If you looked at the photo of him, the caption would be "The Last Mogul." I mean, he's sitting there with, you know, the cufflinks.
He looked adorable.
With the glasses, his hair, he's got the stogie. I mean, he's like the last mogul. The reality of it is, I would say, Tom, wouldn't you, that he was sort of sinking into a certain degree of dementia.
Well, he might have been. I mean, the thing was is that he, you know, Al Jean Harmetz in her wonderful The Making of the Wizard of Oz book that came out years ago kind of alluded to it, too. He was sort of like Arthur Freed in that he was nonverbal. So I think even when he was a younger man, he just wasn't very articulate.
He was not a verbose fella.
No, and he wasn't a great conversationalist. And then we're seeing him really when he's kind of close to the end. So he was even less of a great conversationalist. But he would, you know, he'd sort of chirp out, you know, few lines about Wizard of Oz.
I love those.
He'd point us to a picture and we'd go over there and look at it. But he did do one thing, which could have been it was a huge favor, although it didn't pan out.
Oh, yeah.
He asked us, who have you seen or who do you want to see that you haven't been able to get to? And we sort of just mentioned, well, Jimmy Stewart, we'd love to see him. But we haven't gotten anything from him. And he said, let me call him up. And we were sort of caught flat-footed because we didn't know that was what he was going to do. And he rang him up. We'll never know for sure if he rang him up. Maybe he rang, you know, an empty office just to impress us.
Or the weather. The time is 12:22. Yeah. Remember these?
Yeah. He didn't, he didn't connect with Jimmy. But we were ready to go, you know, hiking on over to his house if that would have happened.
But that was sweet of him to even pretend to do if it was just pretense. And perhaps he did.
The other person he volunteered, which, again, I think he was sort of sinking into some dementia by that point in the early 80s, was Hal Wallace, who we would have loved to, because if you look at, you know, his resume, it was quite impressive between Elvis and Casablanca and Lewis and Martin, but we never got to Hal Wallace, who at that point was living in the Palm Springs area.
Yeah. So I just mentioned, he said he was like the everything of the Wizard of Oz.
He discounted, Arthur Freed's contribution.
But it was so funny. In it, he said, well, Arthur Freed is dead, and I don't want to say anything about him. But then he says, I did everything.
But they had a feud about that movie for years. I mean, there was the Arthur Freed camp and the Mervyn LeRoy camp. And they were feuding for years and years. They had a falling out over that. And I think really it is pretty much on record that Arthur was the main mover and shaker behind that movie. In fact, he was definitively the one that made sure that Over the Rainbow was not cut from the film, which a lot of the studio people thought held up the movie.
He
said, if you cut that film or that number out of the film, that song, I'm going to quit. So they didn't do it.
Why would they want to cut that beautiful song out of it?
Well, there would be no Wizard of Oz without it.
Really? I believe that. Yeah. And it goes on for now. And it just shows you.
It's one of the greatest film songs in history.
I think so. I love that song. And it can give me goosebumps.
You argue about him versus Freed on Oz. I mean, it's not an argument to say, but a little lesser is that in 55, there was dual director credit for a great film, Mr. Roberts, which was, which was John Ford and Mervyn LeRoy. And I think, Ford, because of his, very well-pronounced affinity to the bottle, became such a liability that they replaced him with Mervyn LeRoy. I think Henry Fonda's relationship with Jack Ford was permanently impaired at that experience. But, you don't know to this day, or I don't know, maybe someone does, what scene was LeRoy's, what scene was shot by Ford.
Yeah. But I loved his tack on, he could not stand Ray Bolger.
Well, that was his opinion.
Right. And he said those little, he talked about the munchkins. What did he call them? Those little munchkin bastards. They were all over the place.
That's sort of legendary, too. And, what is legend? What is reality?
I mean, the orgies they had and stuff like that.
When the legend becomes fact, we talk about the legend, right?
Right.
But there was books and stories about the munchkins and, what havoc they were on the set. He did touch on it. Like I said, I would say, we debated the inclusion of Leroy because I think he was sort of losing it at the time. And it's a little thin on great stories or rich anecdotes, but I think the photo and just his name and, we debated and.
The ambience around it with his man Friday, the fake British, valet that's really
yes.
around. I mean, it was just so bizarre.
Was he a fake British guy?
Well, yeah, I don't know if he's playing a role, but it was just, it was ridiculous. It was like Jeeves or something. So, it was just funny, it was just so bizarre. And then, coming up the elevator and Ronnie Schell getting his
hand that's right.
in the elevator. I mean, it was just bizarre from the beginning to the end. So that's sort of why that made the cut. But
yeah, but it was
good stuff.
He was fun. As you guys are, tell me if you can. Who was your favorite interview?
Well, and this is sort of a weird answer. Well, it's not weird, but we always look at Fred and Gene because there would be no book, and we wouldn't be talking to you if it wasn't for them. And Gene, because we were at his house on two separate occasions over about a 15-year period, was special, and we did get Christmas cards from him every year.
Oh, how
and
nice!
We still have those. And, the Cagney interview was memorable, spectacular. He was pretty reclusive, so that was a rare opportunity.
I adore him. I had the two Cagners on. I think you know him, David.
Yes.
Lisa and Dana. Love those girls.
Carlo, yes.
Yes, I love those. And they're going to come on and we're going to talk about his later life. But they went to visit him.
And one of the great things, one of the things positives of social media is that what they're doing on the Facebook Cagney site, which now probably has a few thousand.
It does. Good for them.
It's keeping his legacy alive, and that's a tremendous thing to do.
He deserves it. And I just love Jimmy, and I thought he was an amazing actor.
How many other? Wonderful.
Well, just a really meaty interview. And one of the longest ones we did before RJ was Rod Steiger. And it was very intense. We were, up on Zumira's Drive up above Malibu where he lived and out on his patio. And it was the only interview we ever voluntarily had to end ourselves.
Wow.
It was getting so dark, we couldn't see him. He was across the patio talking, but he had just incredibly incisive, interesting anecdotes about a lot of the people, James Dean, Gary Cooper, people he worked, Humphrey Bogart in The Harder They Fall. He had this incredible story about working with Humphrey Bogart and just his whole battle for respect that he had had all his life in being an actor from that dated back to the mean streets of Newark when he grew up and his mom was a drunk and he was called out of school all the time to pick her up.
Awful.
And he said his whole life has been nothing but gaining and trying to, gain respect for the Steiger name based on those early days when he was sort of scarred. And, he just had wonderful, wonderful stories, and he was a great interview. So,
and underrated. Yeah.
Very underrated actor. He's done a lot of great stuff. And he dated Elizabeth Taylor at one point. I remember he was wearing a very big pendant later on in life.
That scene he did in the back of the cab from
On the Waterfront
with Brando. It's an immortal scene. Dissected 86 different ways by Kazan and others. And classic.
He was
pawnbroker.
Oh, I loved him in The Still of the Night. He was so good. I loved him. He's a good actor, and he's made some really great films.
Yeah, and let's not forget, Oklahoma too. So
He was versatile.
What's her name in that one? Gloria Graham. And she was a pain in the buttocks, as they said. She was like a noir dame, and she couldn't sing, right?
No, I don't think she was dubbed, but it was weird casting. They had Eddie Elbert playing the Persian peddler.
Which
is a pretty poor accent to boot.
Yeah.
A Persian peddler, Eddie Elbert, who's so all-American looking.
Yeah, he's a Midwest guy.
Yeah.
He's a Minnesota. Right.
Yeah.
Who was your least favorite? You don't have to tell me. You can whisper it. Or do you have a least favorite? Because you appreciate everybody that came on. Because that's how I am. I appreciate any guest I get. Of course, in my head,
I have someone gone crazy. We talked about Donna and having the first interview with Donna. It was difficult. There was a few interviews that we did that, you know, through the years that never made the book. And I mean, I think another one that was like one word answers that never made the book was an actor. I don't know if people even recall his name. He's still alive. Tom Skerritt.
Yes, I know Tom Skerritt. I thought he was more a 70s, 80s guy.
He was like in Top Gun and stuff like that. But, you know, in the 90s, we were doing some more what I would call more contemporary because, again, we were selling them to magazines and things like that. But he was pretty unsellable because it was pretty forgettable. But, sometimes they were a little thin on the information.
Yeah.
Were not quite as forthcoming, but I wouldn't say, you know, no one was an a-hole. Again, Stanley on that first one was a little bit. But other than that, I mean, it's not like we would tell you, I think, right, Tom, if we hated or someone was a real
a-hole. I mean, the thing about a lot of these interviews, and even Stanley Donen, was that, you know, it was a difficult interview when it happened, but it was really fun. I mean, and as it turned out, it made a great story. So,
yes, fabulous story.
From that standpoint, from a journalistic standpoint or a writing standpoint, sometimes, you know, the weaker ones were the better ones, you know, because you could really, you know, they were real colorful and they were bizarre, like Mervyn LeRoy. So, I mean, not everyone can be, you know, R.J., you know, Wagner or Rod Steiger. It's just not going to happen. You're going to get people that are okay or that maybe are a little thin, but that something happens during the interview or that gives it a lot of color and makes it a lot of, you know, very interesting. So I think we were really blessed by, you know, interviewing a lot of these older stars and a lot.
Tom?
Yeah.
You blocked that on me.
Oh, well.
He didn't say anything worth hearing. Don't worry.
No, I on.
No, he basically tied the ribbon on the package and said, while the few of them were thin, they were fun and there were interesting nuggets in virtually everyone. And, you know, no one, you know, booted us out of the house. Lucy came close, but no one actually did.
Well, that was nice. And you guys did this book. There's so many people, Charlton Heston, Bob Hope. I love the one you do for Milton Berle. I love Don Rickles. There's so many. Esther Williams, who was rather controversial after she did her biography. I can't even say. There's, of course, Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, 75, Debbie Reynolds, tons and tons and tons. Andre Previn, just, a grand selection of old-time movie stars. And you guys, I like the way you write. I like the humor as well, your little anecdotes. I can just see you two talking together after an interview, and it must have been fun. So it's a great book to buy, guys. And
no, thank you.
It really is. And, you know, you don't have to read it all at once. You can kind of just go back to it. And especially fun if you're watching a movie and then you see, that's kind of fun. So I just love the book. And
thank you.
I love you boys. And what am I going to say here? I've been talking really nasal, so I was trying to do a little bit of Joan Crawford changed her voice, you know, so because I don't want to sound nasal all the time. But
the throaty sound or whatever, but
something that's not so schnozzy. Anyway, the name of the book is Hollywood Heyday, 75 Candid Interviews with Hollywood Legends, and these was written by my guests today, David Fantle and Tom Sullivan, who does not look like Art Carney, right?
Actually, Tom Johnson. I don't know who Tom Sullivan is, but I'm thinking of changing my name to it.
Maybe Tom Jerry Johnson. Sullivan. You know, Jerry I Sullivan, even know it.
Jerry Sullivan is not in the book.
Isn't that funny? Oh, my God. I'm so sorry to do that because I know it's Tom Johnson. I have it written down everywhere as Tom Johnson. I was just looking at the book. I'm insane. I told you.
That's okay.
And you don't look like Art Carney.
I hope not.
No, Mr. Johnson, you do not.
No, that was
Although it could be worse. It could be she could have said Lon Chaney. I don't know.
Oh, true. Or Lon Chaney Jr.
Yeah, Jr.
he was a guest.
Fester.
Oh dear. I wonder if it is in the Smithsonian. I went there not that long ago because my niece was living there, and of course the Fonz's coat was there. Archie Bunker's chair, but I don't remember Fester. But perhaps I just missed it. Right. So I want to thank you guys for coming on a lovely Sunday and taking time to talk to us. And you're fabulous. I love you guys.
Thanks, Grace. Thanks great to reconnect. Great.
Yes.
Okay. You be well.
You too. And I'd love to talk to you again. And thanks a million, you guys. 75 candid interviews. Hollywood Hating.
Go to Amazon.
Yes, go to Amazon. I'll link that up on my Facebook page as well so you can just get right to it. But, you know, really good. They did great interviews. I'll put their pictures up again. They're adorable. And
thanks, Joyce.
They were great. Thank so thank you. Okay. And hopefully we'll talk soon. Keep in touch.
Very good.
Yes,
thanks,
we will. Bye-bye.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Dudes. Bye.
The Club. Pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment. The lights on the lady in tights, or the bride with the guy on the side, or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment. Be hot, simply teeming with sex. A gay divorcee who is after her ex. It can be Oedipus Rex, where a chap kills his father and costs a lot of bother. The clerk who is thrown out of work by the boss, who is thrown for a loss by the skirt, who is doing him dirt. The world is the stage. The stage is a world of entertainment. The screen, a swain getting slain for the love of a queen. Some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet and everyone ends in mincemeat. The gag may be waving the flag that began with the Mr. Cohan. Hip hooray, the American way. The world is a stage. The stage is a world of entertainment.